Welcome to the deep dive.
Yeah.
Today, we're stepping into a really intense world.
Definitely high stakes.
Yeah, we're looking at negotiation techniques, but not from, the usual business books. These were forged in FBI hostage negotiation.
Life or death situations, literally, where emotion isn't just present, it's pretty much everything.
Exactly. And our main source here is the work of Chris Voss, particularly his book, Never Split the Difference. We're digging into that framework.
Great. And our mission really is to pull out his core idea. He calls it tactical empathy.
Tactical empathy, okay.
Yeah, and show how these techniques, the very same ones used with like kidnappers and terrorists, can actually help you get better results.
In everyday stuff.
Totally. Salary negotiations, business deals, heck, even just trying to get your kids to do their homework. Because Voss's big argument is that fundamentally those old negotiation models, they fail. They assume people are logical.
And where? Not always.
Often not, especially under pressure.
And Voss has the credentials to back this up, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. This is Chris Voss. We're talking about former lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI.
Wow.
24 years, over 150 international hostage situations, dealing with groups like Al-Qaeda.
Okay, so if it works there.
It probably works when you're asking for a raise, right?
Yeah.
The principles scale.
Makes sense. So let's get into that core idea, this paradigm shift he talks about.
Okay, so the big thing Voss does is he basically throws out a lot of conventional wisdom. You know, the stuff about finding logical common ground, aiming for compromise.
Yeah, like getting to yes,
Yeah,
standard stuff.
right. He argues negotiation isn't really a logical debate. It's much more of an emotional journey. It's about discovery and influence. You can't just ignore the emotions,
You have
but
to work with them.
or maybe through them. Exactly. And that leads directly to his key concept, tactical empathy.
Okay, unpack that. Because empathy sounds nice, but tactical sounds calculating.
It does, a little, but it's not about being fake. Tactical empathy is the deliberate skill of understanding the feelings and the mindset, the why behind what the other person is saying or doing.
Understanding their perspective,
Yeah.
even if you don't agree with it.
Precisely. You don't have to agree. You just need to recognize it, understand it, and then you use that understanding strategically
Oh.
to build trust, build rapport really quickly, and then you can subtly guide them towards a solution. The ideal outcome is they feel like they came up with the solution themselves.
Ah, okay. So it's not about forcing agreement. The immediate goal is something else.
Yeah, the immediate goal changes completely. It's not agreement, it's information gathering.
Information gathering.
You're trying to uncover what's really driving them, their hidden needs, their fears, the things they aren't saying out loud. Voss calls these the black swans.
Black swans, the
Yeah.
unexpected game changers.
Exactly. And that's why the book's title is Never Split the Difference.
Okay, hold on. That still feels wrong somehow. Isn't compromise like the definition of a good negotiation? Both sides give a little.
Voss argues it's actually a failure, or at least it's lazy.
Lazy. How so?
Because if you just meet in the middle, you haven't done the hard work. You haven't dug deep enough to find out that there was a better solution possible. You haven't found the real issues or maybe some hidden value that could have made both sides happier. Splitting the difference often means both sides feel like they lost something.
Okay, I see. You didn't maximize the potential. So if the goal is gathering info, we need tools for that. Tools to get them talking without putting their guard up.
Exactly. And the simplest one, the one you can use immediately, is mirroring.
Mirroring, like copying them.
Sort of, but really subtle. You just repeat the last one to three key words they said, usually as a question.
Okay, give me an example. Let's say my manager says, this project deadline is really tight.
You just respond gently, really tight.
That's it.
That's it. It sounds almost too simple, right?
Yeah.
But psychologically, it works. Well, it creates a feeling of similarity, like you're on the same wavelength. It makes them feel listened to. And crucially, it encourages them to elaborate, to explain why it's tight without you having to agree or push back.
They just keep talking.
Often, yes. Voss tells a story about a kidnapping in Haiti, super volatile situation. Just using mirroring helped build a connection with the captors, got them talking, calmed things down slightly. It's about encouraging them to reveal more.
Okay, mirroring. That seems doable. But what happens when they do elaborate and maybe they start venting, getting angry or frustrated? Our instinct is usually to jump in, defend, or shut it down.
Right, and that's where the next tool comes in, labeling.
Labeling, as in labeling their emotion.
Exactly. You verbalize the emotion that you're sensing from them based on your tactical empathy. You basically hold up a mirror to their feelings.
Do you just say, you sound angry? That seems like it could backfire.
Good point. No, the phrasing is really important. You need to soften it, make it an observation, not an accusation. You start with phrases like, it seems like, or it sounds like, or it looks like.
Oh, okay. Softer.
Yeah. So if someone slams their fist on the table, you wouldn't say, you're angry. You'd say, calmly, it seems like you're feeling really frustrated right now.
And the effect of that is?
It validates their feeling. They feel understood. That instantly diffuses a lot of the negative energy. It creates psychological safety, makes them feel heard, and surprisingly makes them more open to actually solving the problem. You do with the emotion first.
Address the feeling before the facts. I like that. Okay, this next one you mentioned, mastering no. This feels like the weirdest one. We spend our lives trying to get people to say yes. Why would we want to no?
It's a huge mental shift, I know. But think about it. No isn't failure. For the other person, saying no makes them feel safe. It gives them a sense of control.
Control.
Because they've drawn a line. They've asserted their autonomy. Once someone feels safe and in control, they actually relax. They're often more willing to then clarify their real position because they don't feel like they're being backed into a corner. A forced yes is useless, but a genuine no tells you something important.
Okay, but how do you get them to say no without just ending the conversation? Aren't you risking shutting things down?
Not if you frame it right. You actually invite the no with certain types of questions. Questions that give them permission to reject the premise safely.
Like what?
Like asking something negatively. Instead of, do you want to try finishing this by Friday? You might ask, is it a ridiculous idea to even think about finishing this by Friday?
Okay. You're making it easy for them to say no.
Exactly. They can comfortably say, well, yeah, it is kind of ridiculous because, and that because is pure gold. That's the information you need, the reason behind the no.
Got it. So mirroring gets them talking, labeling diffuses negative emotions,
yeah.
And mastering no makes them feel safe and reveals their underlying reasons.
You got it. And when you use these effectively, you're working towards the real breakthrough moment.
Which isn't yes.
No. According to Voss, the real goal, the sign you've truly connected and understood, is getting them to say, that's right.
That's right. How is that different from, say, you're right. They sound similar.
Huge difference. You're right is often just a polite way people brush you off. They want you to stop talking. Think about it. Yeah, you're right. It dismisses the conversation.
Okay. I can see that.
But that's right. That's different. That's the sound of someone feeling totally understood. It means you've summarized their situation, their feelings, their perspective so accurately that they feel a click of recognition.
Can you give an example? Say we're talking about a missed deadline.
Sure. If you just say, it seems like this deadline was challenging, they might say, yeah, you're right, and just want to move on. But if you dig deeper, maybe label the underlying issue. Okay, so it sounds like the real frustration isn't just the delay. It's that you felt your team didn't get the support they needed from marketing, which put you in a tough spot.
Okay.
If they respond to that with a thoughtful, that's right, that's your green light, they feel understood, now you can actually start solving the problem together.
That's the moment the dynamic shifts.
Exactly. That's when you've earned their trust and attention. And then you transition to maintaining control, subtly, using calibrated questions.
Calibrated questions. What makes them calibrated?
They're open-ended, and they almost always start with what or how. Critically, you avoid why.
Why avoid why? Oops.
Because why instinctively puts people on the defensive. Why did you do that? Sounds like an accusation.
Right. Okay. So what and how questions?
Yes. These questions are designed to make the other person feel like they're in control, like they're the ones figuring things out, but you're actually guiding the conversation. You're shaping their thinking without them realizing it.
And the classic example from the book is the response to an unreasonable demand.
Yes. The powerhouse phrase. How am I supposed to do that?
It sounds simple, but why is it so effective?
Because you're not saying no. You're not being directly confrontational. Instead, you're framing it as their problem to solve alongside you.
You're making them consider your perspective, your constraints.
Precisely. It forces them to stop demanding and start thinking collaboratively about the implementation. It's like a little bit of psychological judo, using their momentum to shift the dynamic. Other examples are things like, what are we trying to accomplish here? Or how can we make this work?
Turns confrontation into collaboration. Okay. Now, beyond questions, Voss also talks about shaping their perception, kind of bending their reality a bit.
Yeah, leveraging known psychological principles.
Yeah.
Like loss aversion.
Loss aversion. The idea that losing hurts more than winning feels good.
Exactly. People are generally twice as motivated to avoid a loss than they are to achieve an equivalent gain. So when you're making a proposal, don't just focus on the upside. Frame it in terms of what they stand to lose if they don't agree.
So instead of "our service will boost your profits," it's more like "without our service, you're losing market share every day."
That's the idea. It creates urgency. Anchoring is another one, setting an extreme initial position to make your real offer seem more reasonable later.
We see that in pricing all the time. But what of the word fair? People use that a lot in negotiations, and it feels tricky.
It often is trippy. Voss points out that when someone says, "we just want what's fair," or accuses you of not being fair, it's frequently a manipulation tactic.
To make you defensive.
Yes. To make you feel guilty and concede points just to prove you're reasonable.
So how do you counter that? You can't just say, "I am being fair."
No, arguing is pointless. You turn it back on them. You pause, look thoughtful, and then ask them to define it for you. Something like, "okay, help me understand. Could you tell me specifically what part of this you feel has been unfair?"
You make them justify the accusation.
Exactly. They have to articulate their reasoning, which often reveals their actual sticking point or maybe even a black swan. You regain control by making them explain rather than defending yourself.
Very clever. Okay, so we've mirrored, labeled, navigated, used calibrated questions. We've reached an agreement. But agreement isn't everything, right? Execution matters.
Hugely important. An agreement that doesn't stick is worthless. You need to constantly check for commitment and watch for incongruence.
Incongruence, like words not matching actions.
Or words not matching tone or body language. Voss brings up the old 7-38-55 rule.
Right. 7% words, 38% tone, 55% body language.
Yeah. Now, the exact percentages are debated, but the core point is solid. Nonverbal cues carry enormous weight. If someone says, "yes, we have a deal," but they sound hesitant or they're leaning back, arms crossed, that yes is fragile.
So you're listening with your eyes, too. What do you do if you sense that disconnect?
You test the commitment even after they've verbally agreed. You use more how questions, but this time focused on implementation. Mm-hmm. Like, "okay, great. How will we make sure we stay on track with this next week?" Or, "how should we handle it if resource X becomes unavailable?"
You're making them visualize the execution.
Exactly. It forces them to think through the practical steps, which uncovers potential problems early and crucially cements their psychological buy-in. They start planning how to make it work.
Okay, this is a very comprehensive toolkit.
Sure.
Before we get to the ultimate goal, the black swans, you mentioned Voss has a specific model for price negotiation. The Ackerman model.
Yeah, the Ackerman model is basically where tactical empathy meets hard bargaining on price. It's a structured approach.
How does it work? Is it just haggling?
It's structured haggling. You start by setting your target price in your head. Your first offer should be significantly lower. Voss suggests around 65% of your target.
Oh, man, lowballing.
Well, anchoring low. Then you plan three more offers, making progressively smaller increases, maybe to 85%, then 95%, then finally 100% of your target price.
So decreasing increments, why?
It signals you're approaching your limit, but the real psychological trick comes with the final offers.
What's that?
The last couple of offers, especially the final one, should use precise, non-round numbers.
Instead of offering, say, $10,000, you offer $9,873.
Exactly. Or $10,124 if you're the seller. That specific non-round number makes it seem like you've done careful calculations, like you sharpened your pencil down to the last penny. It implies this is your absolute limit based on real constraints, not just a number you plucked out of the air.
Leaves less room for them to think they can just split the difference again.
Precisely. It signals finality. And he also suggests throwing in a small monetary item on that final offer to really show you're tapped out financially.
Fascinating detail. Okay, so that's the structured approach. But underlying all of this is the hunt for the black swans.
The black swans. These are the ultimate prize in negotiation. The unknown unknowns.
The pieces of information that, if you discover them, change everything.
Completely. They could be hidden constraints the other side has, hidden motivations, unexpected stakeholders. Things they don't even realize are that important sometimes.
And you don't find these by asking directly.
Almost never. You find them through intense curiosity, active listening, paying attention to the little details, the things said in passing, the slight hesitations. It's about digging beneath the surface constantly.
Can you give an example of a black swan in action from Voss's experience?
Sure. He talks about the Abu Sayyaf kidnapping case in the Philippines. Negotiations stalled for months over ransom demands that seemed impossible. The Black Swan wasn't about the money directly. It turned out the captors had a hidden need. They needed to appear strong and uncompromising to the outside world for recruitment and reputation, even if, internally, they might have wanted a quicker resolution.
Ah, so it was about their image.
Exactly. Once Voss's team understood that hidden constraint, they could structure a deal that allowed the captors to save face while still achieving the release. Finding the Black Swan unlocked the whole thing.
Wow. So bringing it all together then, for you listening, the big takeaways are...
Negotiation isn't about battling, it's about discovery. Compromise, or splitting the difference, is often a sign you didn't discover enough. And real control comes not from dominating, but from understanding and guiding, giving them the illusion of control.
And the tools are listening, empathy, rapport, emotional intelligence skills.
Fundamentally, yes. This whole framework, it's really a guide to better human interaction in general. It shifts your focus from just broadcasting what you want to actively trying to understand the other person's world, their perspective, their fears, their needs.
And it works outside of hostage situations and boardrooms. Like, think about dealing with a teenager.
Oh, perfect example.
Instead of just ordering them, do your homework now, which guarantees resistance.
Right. Defensiveness immediately.
You could use a calibrated question. Like, how can you get your homework done and still have time to hang out with your friends tonight?
See the difference. You're not commanding. You're inviting collaboration. You're making them solve the problem within your necessary constraint. Homework needs doing. They feel empowered. They own the solution more.
That shift from command to collaboration, that feels like the core of it.
That's the lasting insight, I think.
So here's a final thought for you to take away from this deep dive. If basically every interaction we have is a kind of emotional negotiation, from the checkout line to your most important relationships, what crucial piece of information, what hidden need, what black swan might you be missing right now, simply because you haven't quite listened hard enough for that?
That's right.
Well, find that and you might unlock a lot more than just a better deal.
Something to think about.